This morning, we'll be talking about some research that Harvey has led over the last year on overcoming barriers to scale to reaching the poor. Harvey, as I said, led this work and is closest to it, so in a moment I'm going to pass it to him. But before doing that, I just want to set a little bit of the context for his talk and for our talk this morning. Over the last 5 years or so, there's been a lot of excitement in this thing that I think we as a field haven't really settled on what we're calling it yet. Some call it inclusive businesses, some call it market-based solutions, others impact enterprises. But basically, it's an enterprise that is commercially viable, that is doing something that serves poor communities and is capable of scaling. And the reasons for the excitement are pretty clear. You know, it's once you sort of inject some capital into this enterprise and get it going, once it's up and running, it can carry on by itself, right? You don't need to keep infusing it with more and more donor money. And ideally, it's scaling as well. So if we can get enough of these sorts of things going, you know, we can really move the meter and affect change and reduce poverty, alleviate poverty around the world. So it's exciting stuff, and certainly we as a firm have been very excited about it and big proponents of this approach to development. Now, that said, one could have some skepticism about how much impact these enterprises have had. Has reality really reached the hype? And we've certainly done some research ourselves into this as well. And I'm looking at, I want to talk to some data on slide six here. This is data from a few years ago, not from Harvey's most recent work, but from a few years ago, where our teams went out in the field and we tried to identify some of these impact enterprises. The chart on the left, you can see that we went out and we interviewed a lot of enterprises. We found about 440 or so companies that we found had some promise. And by this, it's not a real kind of rigorous definition. It's our impression that this is an operation that has some ambition to scale. It's doing something pretty constructive. It's not just a grocery store or a vegetable stand or something like that. It's a real going concern. Of those 440 or so, about 140 were commercially viable. Okay, so most of them were not even commercially viable. And of those, only 59 were at scale by our definition. That is not a huge number. While there's certainly promise here, so far we haven't really had the kind of impact that I think we've all hoped these sorts of enterprises would have. On the right side of this chart is just some survey data of impact enterprises, of impact investors, where it indicates something I think we're all aware of, that one frustration impact investors have is they're looking for deals, looking for impact enterprises in which to invest, is they really have trouble deploying all their capital, right? They can't find enough deals at scale that make sense and seem like they're going to have both the social impact and the financial return that's sort of attractive enough to the investors to get them to make those investments. And so again, it's difficult to find a lot of these enterprises that are really kind of having that impact in the market. Now, this is actually pretty important. It's not just that there's some wealthy individuals or wealthy institutions that are a little frustrated because they can't deploy their capital. Right? That's not necessarily something we should be concerned about. But the problem is what we have is a situation where there is, relatively speaking, a lot of money going after a few deals, right? So a lot of money chasing few deals. And if you think about it, we actually have a term for this sort of thing, right? This is what we call an asset bubble, right? So if you think back to 2008 and the housing bubble, what we had is a lot of money chasing a relatively small number of houses. And so the price of houses went up, right? If you think back to 2001, we had a lot of money chasing a relatively few number of dot-com companies. So the price on the dot-com companies went way up, right? So these are bubbles, and what tends to happen with bubbles is they burst, and they burst in unpredictable and unpleasant ways. and so the question has to be asked, do we have an impact enterprise bubble right now? Are we facing a situation where investors will chase these deals, will get a bubble, and eventually it'll burst. And it's not too difficult to imagine what the impact investors are going to say is, you know, well, that was a great idea, but unfortunately, it's just not working out, and I can't get a social return, I can't get a financial return, so I'm just not going to invest in this asset class anymore. So that's the fear, right? Because if that happens, then we as a kind of economic development community have missed a chance to deploy a lot of capital in ways that could really help a lot of poor people around the world, and that would obviously be a huge shame. Hence, our interest in how do we scale up, how can we scale up more of these sorts of impact enterprises or market-based solutions? This is a kind of important question at the moment. And now I'm talking to slide five in the deck. Historically, we as a firm have argued that in order to scale, it's really important to pay attention to the business model, right? Lots of different things matter. The team matters, the idea matters, the product matters, all this sort of stuff. Capital matters. but the kind of underappreciated and yet really important thing is the business model, right? So how are you going to make your product? Who are you going to sell it to? What market segments? What kind of messaging and marketing you're going to have around that? To those segments, how you're going to distribute your product, like how are you going to do this? There's lots and lots of different ways to produce and sell and distribute your goods, and figuring out how to do that, figuring out what the business model is, that's really important. Because if you don't get that right, you could have the coolest idea, you could have the best technology, but it's just going to sit on a shelf and not go anywhere. We have lots and lots of examples of very cool, very productive technologies that have been deployed in the developed world that are not getting deployed in the developing world. And often this has to do with the business model that just doesn't quite work in that environment. So historically, we paid a lot of attention to business models. That said, we've always recognized that there's something about the business environment around that business model that matters a lot. It's not as though there's just sort of certain business models that work in all times and all cases, and it's just a question of, you know, picking the right one off the shelf. There's kind of an interplay between the business model and the environment in which it sits. And to some extent, the business model solves for certain deficiencies in that environment, and hence it works. And so it's often about fitting the business, it seems to be about fitting the business model to the environment. So we have always wanted to kind of dig into this environment and come to understand it better and understand the interplay between the business model and the environment. And that is something that Harvey and his team have been doing over the course of the last year. So we think kind of in combination, understanding business models, understanding the business environment, and how to overcome barriers to scaling in the environment will hopefully help us push along the way to understanding how to scale these impact enterprises. So hopefully we can avoid an impact bubble if, in fact, we do have one. So with that context setting, let me pass it to my colleague Harvey, who will talk about the research that he and his team have been doing over the past year or so. And looks like he's going to start off by talking about the four stages of pioneer firm development. Harvey?
And so when we spoke to impact investors, the people that Kurt was describing there, you know, part of the reason they can't find deals is because they're looking all the way on the right-hand side, right? So we spoke to investors. They said, we want to find enterprises that have already achieved, you know, break-even, they're already scaling, you know, they're low risk, you know, but confident they can achieve their plans, and then want to put money in and get them to scale. Hardly anyone was investing earlier on in these difficult stages, especially validate and prepare. And so part of what we did was call out this, what we call the pioneer gap, right? Recognizing that firms that are pioneering new models take on shoulder disproportionate risk in terms of proving out that model. And so what we need to do is direct more support, and in particular, more risk tolerant, more flexible, more patient capital to those who are pioneering new models. So that's part of what we did, and the conversations actually developed, I think, even over the last 2 years, and we're seeing a lot more activity now in this pioneer gap, accelerators, funding coming in to fill that gap. But a lot of what we've seen is still at the level of the enterprise, right? Because, and, you know, I guess we're partly to blame for that because we said, you know, let's look at the pioneer firm and kind of focus our resources on the pioneer firm because they're kind of pioneering the model. But what's interesting for us when we reflect on the actual stories of scale that we've seen and that we've been working on in India and Africa is not all the barriers to scale are at the level of the firm. Right? So you've clearly got barriers to scale at the level of the firm. You've got, you know, lack of investment, lack of capacity, lack of leadership, lack of the right know-how, technical skills, all of those things at the level of the enterprise. But then you look a bit further and you say, well, okay, actually there could be barriers outside of that, right? There could be gaps in the value chain. They don't have the inputs they need. They don't have the distribution they need. They don't have the financing that they need. Their customers don't have the financing that they need. So all of these things are gaps in the value chain or linkages that are broken in the value chain that could really inhibit growth, right? So you could operate in a very small area and do perfectly well, but you can't go much further because of those gaps. But then we thought, actually, there are some issues beyond that, right? And that's when we got to the area of public goods. So one of the biggest barriers that we see with new models growing is just a lack of information and know-how in terms of how to expand, where to expand, where the opportunities are. There are gaps in terms of standards, quality standards in the market that disadvantage new models. There could be gaps in terms of awareness. So, you know, are customers aware that there are these beneficial products that they could buy and that they're good for them, they're worth buying? As well as all the usual ones around kind of physical infrastructure, right? The usual things we think about in terms of public good. So there are a whole bunch of public goods gaps that may be barriers to scale. And then finally, we thought, actually, there's a bunch of barriers that sit at the level of official institutions, government, regulation, and policy. Right? And there could be regulation that's inhibitory to new models. There could be tax and subsidy regimes that are, you know, disadvantage new models. There could be political interventions of various sorts that may not be, you know, systematic, but which may get in the way of new models. And when we looked at this, we thought, actually, this is so interesting, because if you ask a lot of people who are in this space now, who maybe have come in through the impact investing lens, or who may be, you know, donors or foundations working in this space, a disproportionate amount of the focus is on the enterprise. Right? And we think if we want to get them to scale, that's where we invest, surely. And we're saying that's completely right, but we also need to think about the other barriers to scale outside the enterprise and think about what we're doing against those. And so for the past year, we've been working on a research study trying to understand what these barriers to scale are, how they actually play out in the lives of these innovative business models. But then more importantly, what can we do about them? You know, if these exist, what are the actions that we can take as funders, as intermediaries, as investors, as governments, to actually work with enterprises and alongside enterprises to remove some of those barriers to scale? Two things. I'm going to talk to you through a couple of case studies, but before I do that, I'm going to say two things. One is thank you to USAID, who have been a part funder of this. Hi, Rob. Together with seven other agencies and foundations, and they provided both funding but also data, access to data and expertise, which has been really helpful. But also, the second thing is we're not quite ready with this yet. So this is, as advertised, a sneak preview. We're only going to publish probably at the end of March. So if anyone's interested in the report, just give me a card and we'll make sure we put it in the on the mailing list. So we're kind of limited in terms of how much detail we can go to into each of the cases today, but we'll certainly be able to share the high-level descriptions and insights. So that's just a little caveat for you before we dive in. So the first case we're going to talk about, and they're very, very different cases, you know, one is engaging consumers, poor consumers, and the other is engaging poor producers. So the first one's about engaging poor consumers. They're both in East Africa. This one is in Tanzania. Some of you will know about mobile money and the experience of M-Pesa in particular in Kenya, which is kind of widely hailed as this very, you know, successful, beneficial, easy to use, widely scaled product that allows the poor, well, anyone really, but especially the poor, to send money easily, you know, to send remittances, to make payments, to save, you do all sorts of things when they might not be able to do that easily with other methods like using a bank or using a post office or just sending cash. So what we found interesting was that the really interesting story for us with mobile money wasn't in Kenya, which is what everyone talks about, where M-Pesa was hugely successful, launched by Safaricom. What's interesting when you look at Tanzania, which launched M-Pesa a year later, so April 2008, Vodacom Tanzania, which is the sister company to Safaricom in Kenya, part of the Vodafone Group, launched M-Pesa. So the same technology, the same business model. They even took the same marketing campaign. They said, you know, the Send Money Home campaign that worked really well in Kenya, let's use that in Tanzania. What's funny is that it didn't take off, right? So the first year saw very disappointing enrollments and usage. After 14 months, there were, you know, just under 300,000 registered users in Tanzania. The same time, you know, after the same time in Kenya, it had nearly 3 million customers. So very, very different performance. And you know, they're roughly the same population. So we thought, this is kind of interesting. What's different, right? So we looked at the two countries and we thought, they're neighboring countries, they're both in East Africa, but actually they're very different. They're similar size, but the population in Tanzania is much more scattered geographically. They're much less knowledgeable and aware and sophisticated about financial services products. There's lower mobile phone penetration in Tanzania than there is in Kenya. There's a lower density of bank branches. And also there was a weaker remittance culture, right? So part of the reason the Send Money Home campaign didn't work is because in Tanzania people don't have as established a practice of sending money home. Or rather, sending money home using an intermediary. You know, there's a whole culture of if you're going to send money home, you take the money home and you give it to them in person, you know, because that's polite to do. You don't send it on a bus, which is what people would do in Kenya, and for which M-Pesa was a perfect substitute. So all these differences really came out when you compare the two countries. But also the sectors are very different. So telecoms in Tanzania is very different from telecoms in Kenya, as those of you who know it and who've been there will know. So it's a very competitive mobile telecoms industry. So unlike Kenya, where Safaricom has over 80% market share, Vodacom has about 50% market share, and there are three other pretty significant players in Tanzania. So much more competitive. And then the channel structure, so the channels, the agents through whom the mobile companies get their products to market are also set up very differently in Tanzania versus Kenya. So in Kenya, Safaricom, who are the leading player, deal with 1,000 super agents to get their products to market. In Kenya, in Tanzania, the four mobile companies deal with 6 super agents to get their products to market. So a very different dynamic and level of market power in that country versus, in the two countries. So this obviously led to changes in the way that they approach the business. In terms of barriers to scale, I'll just lay this out using the framework that we had. When the mobile money model started in Tanzania, obviously there were gaps in the value chain, right? You're trying to sell a new product. Distribution for the product doesn't exist. Sure, there's a network of airtime resellers that you could, you know, recruit from and retrain and equip them to do mobile money, but they're not there yet. So you need to kind of build that channel, especially to rural markets, which are generally hard to reach with these technologies. And then even when you do build the models, there's a question of financing, right? I mean, this is not the same as selling airtime, right? If people use mobile money in the rural areas, they need to be able to cash in and cash out of the agent. That means agents need to carry cash. Agents need to have, you know, balances on their own mobile money accounts to be able to transact. So you need to think about, you know, filling those gaps. There's also a huge public good barrier, right? Because you're trying to launch a new model and a new product in a country which has never used this product before. Where there's generally a low-level awareness of financial services of any kind, never mind an innovative mobile money service that you're trying to sell them. So you need to deal with that gap as well. And then we thought, at the level of government, there was a potential barrier that had to be addressed because this was a new innovative model that was kind of was outside the banking system, and there was a risk. The regulator would say, the Bank of Tanzania would say, actually, you know, this is not allowed, you can't do this, this is risky, and we're not going to allow the model to operate or to scale. So potentially, the legal and regulatory framework could have been inhibitory towards the new model. So what happened? A few things. So one of them was the model itself had to evolve because of these barriers that were in place. This diagram here shows essentially the model that was inherited from Kenya. So you've got the mobile network operator on the left. If you look at the diagram, they deal with super agents who then have a network of agents who then serve the customer. The agents would, you know, enroll the customer, do cash and cash out transactions with them, right? So that would be the main role that they would play. And in Safaricom in Kenya, this was pretty straightforward because, you know, Safaricom said, you know, look, there are 1,000 of you. There's one of me. You're going to do this, right? And I'm going to train you up. I'm going to give you the resources, but you are going to do this. In Tanzania, right, with four mobile companies and six super agents, you couldn't quite do that. And so what they found was that the super agents actually weren't coming on board fast enough. You know, so part of the reason the growth was slow was because super agents weren't taking up the new product and they weren't pushing it down to their agents and they weren't enrolling customers. So they took a different approach. They said, let's cut the super agents out. Right? They'll still be in the chain, but we need someone else to work alongside them. And they called these people aggregators. They set up a new kind of entity in the value chain who would be partnered with a bank. Aggregators would go out and map resellers in the rural areas, figure out who could be recruited to be an airtime, to be an M-Pesa agent, recruit them, train them, get them in place to sell mobile money, and then tie it with a banking partner who would then provide liquidity for them to have e-float, so, to have a balance on the mobile money account so that they could transact with customers in the regional rural areas. And so that was really the key to them recruiting many more agents, enrolling many more customers, and actually getting the model to grow. And I think this is almost the kind of purest sense of what a scaling barrier is, right? Because it's not that M-Pesa couldn't operate at a small scale using the old model, they just couldn't grow, right? And so the model adaptation was essential to get it to scale. Now, this was the industry timeline of mobile money in Tanzania. So it starts about 2007, where the Bank of Tanzania starts thinking about electronic-based schemes because some of the companies are interested. It then gives permission to Vodacom to establish the new business. Vodacom begins building out the network. In 2010 is when Vodacom decides it's going to change the model and bring in the aggregators to help the model scale and also change the marketing campaign. So from Send Money Home, it changed it to actually you can use this for a whole range of other reasons like paying bills, you know, making insurance payments, paying school fees, using it for all those other applications. And when you look at it this way, you think, well, yeah, this is great, right? This is another corporate-led scale-up story, a little different from Kenya because, you know, it's in a much more competitive environment, but it's still led by corporates. But to look at it this way kind of ignores, I think, two big parts of the story, right? So one is that in terms of changing the model and building awareness and building the value chain, one of the differences, again, between Kenya and Tanzania is that if you're not the big player in telecoms, right, you're the biggest player, but you don't control the market, you don't have the lion's share of the market, there's a real chance that as a first mover, you'll be disadvantaged by making all the early investments. Right. So if you put all the money in to build the agent network, you put all the money in to educate consumers about this new product, and it works, all the other three players are going to be coming in and, you know, stealing your lunch. So how do you get over that disincentive to invest when there are these huge barriers? And the solution in this case was that external facilitators came in and said, this is really important from an impact point of view, and we're going to help break the deadlock. So Gates, the Gates Foundation and GSMA, who are the Global Industry Association for Mobile Network Operators, came in and said, we're going to give grants to Vodacom to do these two things, right? Educate the customer and make them aware. So this was the public goods barrier that we talked about. And also build the value chain, right? Because obviously they will benefit from it, but then other people will also kind of ride on those. Anyone who's been to Tanzania will notice that if you go to a mobile phone shop, there are always four logos in front of the shop, right? So the operators say you have to be exclusive, but actually what they do is each operator has four different books, right? And depending on which one you want, they pull out a different book. So they're exclusive, they've got four businesses, but they're actually all the same counter. So in that kind of environment, you know, it's very easy for other people to come in and ride on the channel infrastructure that you've built. So for Gates to come in and GSMA to come in and build that infrastructure through Vodacom allowed other people then to kind of ride on that that infrastructure. The other piece that was done, which I guess isn't so clear from just looking at the industry timeline, is you think, well, the regulator just, you know, was very progressive, right? And it's true that actually in 2007, the regulator, the BOT, actually was very open to these new systems. They were very concerned about financial inclusion in the rural areas because there have been lots of bank branch closures in the rural areas. But what's interesting is that, you know, policy is never developed in a vacuum, right? And so the BOT actually drew on a whole range of resources from facilitators to help them develop policy. So there's actually a whole timeline of different actions that facilitators have taken. So, you know, nonprofits like the FSDT and Finscope did these surveys to understand financial exclusion in Tanzania, provided that as data to the BOT to help them inform policy. AFI, the Alliance of Financial Inclusion, took the BOT on a study tour to the Philippines in 2008 because there were some early models that had been running in the Philippines on mobile money, said, you know, look at these models, think about how this might work in Tanzania. FSDT, which is a local trust in local nonprofit in Dar es Salaam, organized the first financial inclusion conference in 2010, talked about mobile money. Gates then came in and sent experts in to speak to Vodacom and the BOT about mobile money solutions. And even in 2012, you know, AFI continued to help the BOT by providing this working group where they could get feedback on draft regulations and so on. And so there's a whole kind of hidden story behind the scenes of facilitators working with government, with the company to really make this happen. The results? A scaled industry. So mobile money penetration in Tanzania is now higher as a proportion of the subscriber base than in Kenya. You'll see in the chart on the left that it's not just one company that's dominated. Of course, Player A, and you can guess who that is, has scaled quite significantly, but actually in recent years, you've seen other people come in and actually grow that market as well. So it's actually competitive. As a result of competition, costs to transact are lower in Tanzania. So they're two-thirds lower in Tanzania than in Kenya. And we think that is a direct result of competition in this space. And I think what's interesting is that if you look at the interventions that were done, you know, at the surface, you know, something like the Gates grant was given to one company. But the effect of it has been to lift up the whole industry and remove barriers for the whole industry. And we think that's the essence of what we're calling market or industry facilitation. Key findings. So these are kind of four themes that we found really across all the cases that we've looked at. So let me just talk them through in the case of mobile money. The first is you still have to get the model right, right? So even though we've said it's not all about the firm, it's not all about the enterprise, you've got to think about the system and, you know, scaling barriers across the ecosystem. You still have to get the model right. And the first thing that they had to fix was change the model. You know, don't go through the existing channel structure, bring in new aggregators, work in a different way, change your marketing campaign. You still got to get the model right. But often that's not enough, right? So without the efforts of facilitators like Gates coming in and saying we're going to break the deadlock around investment in public goods and value chain, without FSDT and Gates coming in and saying we're going to help the BOT, you know, inform their development policy, we probably would not have seen the industry scale the way it has. The third piece is leadership. And I bring this up because at the level of single enterprises and technologies and products and firms, we are very accustomed to thinking about leadership. But often when we step up to the level of systems and industries, we stop seeing that. Which is quite strange because actually all these industries are, they're agglomerations of firms, right? And so if we look at this story, we see individuals like the people at Vodacom, for sure. So those are the people we know about, Nick Hughes and Michael Joseph, who came over from Safaricom to help start the model in Tanzania, people at Vodacom in Tanzania, but also people in the regulator, right? So the chairman of the Bank of Tanzania, you know, took a very progressive view towards financial inclusion, really championed the adoption of this model and supported regulation of the model. People like Ignacio Mas and Daniel Radcliffe at Gates played a leading role on the ground in Tanzania over a period of years, really, to kind of make this thing happen. And the role that we see here is really innovative, committed innovative leadership. You know, individuals are committed not just to trying out new things, but to really making them happen over a period of time and betting on making those things happen. And the final thing is money, right? So all these things cost money. Obviously, the direct facilitation on the ground, you know, took a number of years and a lot of concerted effort to make that happen. But also the $5 million investment that Gates and GSMA put into Vodacom to deal with public goods and value chain barriers also, you know, broke the deadlock. Now, what's interesting is that Vodacom has ended up putting in about $20, $25 million investment over the $5 million of grant. So it's not as though the grant money has built the industry, but we think that it broke the deadlock and managed to be catalytic in development. So let me go on. I think we'll probably save questions for the end. Does that make sense, Gene? So the next case we're going to talk about, and this is very different. So this is about engaging smallholders. This is for producers in innovative models. And this is about Kenyan smallholder tea. And this is a much, much longer story. So this story actually starts in the 1950s. And this is the reason we got interested in smallholder tea. If you look at what tea farmers get for the green leaf that they produce per kilo, Kenyan farmers get 53 cents on the kilo, and you can see what farmers in the other countries get. So there's a massive, massive difference between them and the neighboring countries. So we thought, why is that? The story actually starts in the 50s. There's this company called the Kenyan Tea Development Authority, KTDA, which was established in 1964 following a government plan to really expand smallholder tea growing. It's grown over the decades, and in 2000 was privatized, and it's now owned by the smallholders. So it started life as a peristatal, and it's now owned by smallholders to supply the green leaf. Very briefly, this is the model. So this is a classic contract farming model for those of you who are familiar with these models in agriculture. So smallholders sell green leaf to the factory. They get inputs and credit from the company. The company processes the leaf, sells it to buyers, and passes the earnings back to the smallholder. Unusually for these kinds of models, especially for a peristatal, what's interesting about KTDA is that it engaged commercial tea companies to come in and manage the factories and the marketing activities for the first 10 years of its operation, and then it transitioned to managing them in-house. Barriers, so many, right? So if you look at tea in the 1950s for smallholders in Kenya, farmers weren't planting tea, they didn't know how to plant tea, there were no tea bushes in the ground, there were no roads to supply the tea, there were no factories, nothing, right? So I won't go through all of these in detail, but you know, lack of capital, lack of skills, you know, there was no credit to get them to buy inputs, there were no channels for sourcing, smallholders didn't know how to plant tea, there were a few tea varieties, so lots of different barriers. I mean, the only thing that wasn't a barrier was government, because government was right behind the initiative, right? But everything else was a barrier. And so what's interesting is that you had these two complementary efforts that were driven through the 60s and 70s to solve this problem. One was facilitation, which we've talked about, so mainly government agencies and parastatals, so KTDA, the Ministry of Agriculture, the Ministry of Works, the Tea Research Institute, work together to, you know, do research, develop new varieties, do extension services, all the things that we think about normally when we think about smallholders and ag, all the way down to kind of building roads and you know, guaranteeing loans so that we could get capital into KTDA. But I think what's interesting about the story isn't the facilitation, which is what I thought was interesting about mobile money, is actually the enterprise, right? So what was unusual about KDDA when you compare it to lots of other state-sponsored activities in agriculture, especially in the 60s and 70s, is that it was very private sector in its orientation. It engaged commercial tea companies to come in and manage the factories because it realized it couldn't do them itself. It put a lot of effort into thinking about how you create an aggregation network to buy green leaf. It bought into very strict quality standards. So the little picture you see there is the little mantra of two leaves and a bud. That's the kind of gold standard for quality in picking green leaf. And they wouldn't buy anything that didn't meet those standards. So very, very, I would say, religious commitment to a level of quality and enforcing that all the way up and down the value chain. And then, of course, you know, making sure that they could sell at a good price at auction. Results. Speak for themselves. I think we all dream of charts that look like this for the companies that we're involved in. But you know, and this shows them to 1990 because that was kind of the pre-privatization phase. But I'm happy to report that they've continued to do well since then. So they're 200,000 in 1990, or just over. They're now nearly at 600,000 smallholders, and one of the largest exporters of tea and second largest exporter of tea in the world. I won't go into this in detail because I think that's telling me I'm nearly out of time. But one of the things we do explore a little bit in the report when we publish is this comparison between how KTDA has done and what other similar state-sponsored activities in ag have done. So we've compared it against Kenyan smallholder coffee and also Tanzanian tea, which start around the same time. But as you can see from the chart, they haven't had quite the level of success that Kenyan tea has. In fact, Kenyan tea is a huge outlier in terms of performance. But when we look at the reasons for that outperformance, it's pretty much the same themes, right? So the first one is get the model right. One of the things that we see consistently across lots of kind of state-sponsored initiatives, especially in agriculture, is there's a whole focus on facilitation, but not on the enterprise, right? There might be an emphasis on giving smallholders ownership, but not on the model itself or who's going to manage the model. And what we see, interestingly, in the case of KTDA, is there's a lot of effort put into designing the right model, bringing in the right people to run it, who in the first 10 years were not the company themselves, but someone outsourced, commercial tea companies. They didn't really worry about giving ownership to the tea smallholders for 36 years. So it was parastatal for 36 years. And then they got to this question of ownership, which I think is quite interesting. So they got the model right. And everything about the model was focused not on serving the grower, but on serving the customer, which I think is also an interesting distinction here. Because I think often when we think about, you know, unlike the case of serving the poor consumer, where the beneficiary is your customer, so you focus always on them, in this case, you're kind of looking in both directions, right? And you're thinking, let's benefit the smallholder, but we've got to serve the customer. It's so easy to get distracted and say, actually, we're all about serving the smallholder. But actually, the key to growth, as we all know in business, is serving the customer. Facilitation helps. Obviously, there are so many barriers, physical infrastructure, knowledge, varieties of tea, value chain, all those had to be plugged in order for this to work. It takes leadership. So there is a noted researcher of KTDA who has coined a really cool term, I think. He says there are positive deviants in the system. The history of KTDA is a history of positive deviants. Civil servants who bucked the trend and said, actually, we want local smallholders to start growing this new stuff that no one's doing yet. There were leaders within KTDA who said, actually, we don't need these commercial companies running it after 10 years. We can do it ourselves, and we're going to prove it. People within the early investors, so CDC and the World Bank, who said, this is a huge risk, but we're going to take it and prove that this can work. All the way up to, you know, governments and senior ministers who got involved. So I think also in this case, we see the role of individuals who've kind of bucked the trend, seized on innovation, and then committed to seeing it happen. And that's led to success. The final thing is takes money. So if you look, particularly when you look at this across the cases of Kenyan coffee and Tanzanian tea, you'll see that a lot more money has gone into this sector than the others, right? So money does make a difference. It's a blend of money, so it's not all hard commercial capital. Some of it was grant, including some from USAID. And some of it was also soft loan. Most of it was soft loan, actually, to the companies to get this thing to scale. So I'm going to stop there.